Now we are joined by Zephyr Ben-Gash, Crescent International. Are you there, Zephyr?
Yes. Hello, Phil. I am.
Well, thank you very much, Zephyr, for taking this time. You are the go-to person in North America, in my opinion, to unscramble the this new collection of letters. They spell it's ISIS. I guess ISIS.
Yes.
Is. And sometimes ISIL. And it's a very curious phenomenon. It seems to have awakened the pundit gang. They all have something new to chew on.
Yes.
But is this new? Who are the armed gentlemen? what an odd expression. Fighting in northern Iraq with this label involving Syria. Who, in your opinion, are they? And how new is this phenomenon?
Well, basically, this gang was expected to do something after their complete defeat in Syria, because I'm sure your listeners would know that on June the 3rd, there was a presidential election in Syria. And it was incredible, including reported by international observers, that the people of Syria participated in very large numbers in these elections, and they overwhelmingly voted for President Bashar al-Assad. Mm-hmm. And we were told by the Western media as well as by the Western governments that Bashar al-Assad was very unpopular, he was a tyrant, etc., etc. And yet here were the Syrian people. And incredibly, what we witnessed even before the June 3rd elections, that the pre-elections for Syrians in diaspora, particularly in Lebanon, when they came out by the hundreds of thousands on May 28th, and they were all carrying Bashar al-Assad's photographs and Syrian mm-hmm. flags, etc. Mm-hmm. And that was such a slap on the face of all of this propaganda that Bashar al-Assad was unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
And so once it was established that Bashar al-Assad has popular support within the country, then naturally these Western powers, etc., had to change the dial and move on to something else. And so they unleashed this group that, as you rightly pointed out, either goes by the abbreviations ISIS, which stands for Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or also ISIL, Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's made up of overwhelmingly mercenaries from places like Chechnya, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan,
France Britain
Canada, actually, even, yes,
yeah.
You know, it acts as a magnet for all of these mercenaries, these you know, alienated people who are frustrated in their own societies, and they think that they can pick up a Kalashnikov and jump into a Toyota pickup truck,
mm-hmm.
that they can, you know, bring about a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But what they are a bunch of murderous thugs. They have mm-hmm. carried horrible crimes in Syria, and they have done exactly the same thing in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, the problem in Iraq, unfortunately, is that there are, of course, the former elements of Saddam Hussein's army that were disbanded. Then you have these tribal groups that are dissatisfied with the central government. And I think, you know, mm-hmm. we have to admit that, unfortunately, the Maliki government has not been either too sophisticated or that he has acted in a manner that would give people much confidence that he represents everybody rather than his own group of people. And that definitely has contributed to the success of this gang of mass murderers mm-hmm. that have occupied large swaths of Iraq.
Yes. Well, on that point, isn't part of the problem the birth of what they are calling, you know, the Iraqi state system, because it was a result of a U.S. invasion and a bunch of negotiations and the continuing kind of shadow presence of the U.S. plus its relations. I mean, I think, for example, I want to ask you about this. They said, well, we could handle this, but we need the planes. And they say, but the Americans won't deliver the pains. Now, you know, that takes me all way back years ago. I remember when the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Ms. Bhutto,
yes,
she had a problem with Americans, and she said, we want those planes that we bought. And they said, no, we won't give them to you, even though you bought them. And she said, well, then give me the money back.
Money
and they
back.
Said, no, we won't give you the money back.
Yes.
And he needs to defend himself and the Iraqi people. He's going to have to make up his mind, isn't he? I mean, there are people, the Islamic Republic and Russia both seem to be watching this with some curiosity.
Yes, of course, of course. Absolutely. Actually, you know, it's incredible that, you know, we were told that the Iraqi army was trained by the Americans and they spent $25 billion on training them.
By the way, whoever has it ever been demonstrated the Americans are that good at any of this stuff? All this stuff, the fatherly stuff about, oh, I'm training him.
Yes.
To me, that really wouldn't be that reassuring.
Exactly, exactly. So unfortunately, all of that training and the $25 billion that went into training them, and then the Americans wanted to stay on and train them some more. I mean, you know, I think the Iraqis...
There's good money in training, by the way.
Exactly, huge amounts of money, absolutely. And so, but I think it's important to keep in mind that even this bunch of murderous thugs also have Americans embedded with them. So I think, you know, people should know that the Americans are on both sides.
Yeah, and Saddamites.
Yes, absolutely, exactly.
And they might have nuclear weapons. We have to check them out.
Yes, yes. So we are really in a very curious situation. But what I see, the events unfolding in Iraq are that these hoodlums obviously will not be able to last very long. The basic reason for their success was that there was betrayal in the Iraqi army. The officers who were not happy with the present government simply abandoned their positions and told their troops that they are free to do whatever they like. So the officers fled, and the troops were left without any direction. So the troops also decided to flee instead of fighting. And that chaos obviously was augmented by the fact that there were disgruntled tribal elements within that region, particularly the second largest city in Iraq, Mosul, mm-hmm. and of course the nearby town of Tikrit, from which Saddam Hussein had hailed, and of course that's where he's buried as well. So these people were extremely unhappy with the way mm-hmm. the central government in Iraq was conducting itself, and so these tribal people, as well as these disgruntled former military men, found common cause with these terrorist groups that have come from Syria. Although they are led by a person by the name of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, that's the name that he has adopted. His real name is actually Ali Ibrahim al-Samarai. Now, Samarra is the city in Iraq where he was born, and of course his followers try to project him as some kind of a revolutionary leader and a man who mm-hmm. has very impressive educational credentials. His background essentially is that he was taken or captured by the Americans in 2005 and kept in Buka camp after Abu Ghraib became a scandalous place. He was kept for 4 years in Buka camp and then released from there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I am absolutely certain that the Americans struck a deal with him.
Mm-hmm.
And the deal was, and this incidentally has happened to some of the captives from Guantanamo Bay as well, the Americans struck a deal with him that they will let him go and let him organize whatever he wants to do, and they'll even support him so long as he does not challenge or threaten American interests.
Yes.
So we see that the guy makes his debut in Syria.
Setting a thief to catch a thief.
Yeah, absolutely. So we see that he made his debut in Syria, and of course, you know, he also, you know, got involved in fighting with other groups, etc. And when things couldn't go according to U.S.-Saudi Zionist plans in Syria, then of course he was perhaps motivated to move into Iraq, and that's what he did. And of course, the ground situation in Iraq was in his favor. But according to the information that we have received, it wasn't so much the prowess of his fighters as it was the treachery of some elements within the Iraqi armed forces and the tribal people that basically facilitated their takeover of various cities.
Yeah, this is the voice of Zafar Benghash, Crescent International. And Zafar, I wonder about this. The first concern that certainly I had looking at this, this label and continual reference to Syria, 6 months ago, maybe eight now, the U.S. was on the brink of an all-out assault on Syria. And it was absolutely a matter of hours, and it was one of the great breakdowns and step-backs of the U.S. in that Putin of Russia said, no, I'm not going to go along with this. And the British Parliament said, no, we aren't either. And so the frontal assault didn't seem to work out. But the way their language is configured now, they're including Syria in as sort of part of the broad problem. And I just wonder, do you think they are thinking of a backdoor way of getting at Syria? Because if they use that language, that means they can bomb and attack in eastern Syria.
Well, that, I think, is still a distinct possibility. But as you pointed out, it was Russian President Vladimir Putin who put them on notice that he would not stand for that. And also in Britain, where the British Parliament actually in August of 2013 categorically rejected any military involvement in Syria. And of course, this the crisis had heightened as a consequence of the allegation of the use of chemical weapons in Syria, which in fact American intelligence knew was the act not of the Syrian government but of the rebels or the mercenaries working in tandem with the Saudi intelligence chief and at his behest, the former intelligence chief, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who has since been sacked from his position.
Yes, the Saudis are in shaky condition.
Oh,
and by the way, your website, I urge people to go there. It clarifies that.
Oh, absolutely. The Saudis are actually in very great difficulty, and there are rapid changes being made, like every second or third month, some prince is sacked because he has failed to deliver. And
well, we had Bandar threatening Putin at one point, and now Bandar doesn't have a job.
Exactly. the other people that were assigned to the Syria file, as well as handling these terrorists, they are also now out of a job. And it seems that within the Saudi tribal kingdom, there is total chaos and confusion. And in fact, I have a strong feeling, as I read the situation, that this regime is actually teetering on the brink of extinction. And I think the sooner this corrupt regime in Saudi Arabia goes, the better it would be not only for the region but for the entire world. Mm-hmm. Because they are the principal financiers and backers of all of these terrorist organizations.
Yeah, but it is, by the way, when you say that, of course, you're talking about a geostrategic migraine headache for Western imperialism, because that's home base.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So they must be thinking ahead themselves. I guess the Saudis hear them thinking ahead. And they are delighted, are they not, with a lot of this activity in Iraq? I'm told that reports, if you were to watch Saudi and Qatari television, you'd be seeing all kinds of IS enthusiasm.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Although outwardly the Saudis are trying to project an image that they are not keen about these terrorist outfits making so much headway, etc., and They have incidentally branded this group as a terrorist organization. But recent reports have indicated that the group, because it has been, or at least it feels that it has been so successful, that there have been literally thousands of messages on Twitter in which its supporters have said that we now are on the border of Saudi Arabia. And in fact, other messages have said, no, no, we are not on the borders of Saudi Arabia. We are inside Saudi Arabia. And in fact, the Saudi government or the military in May issued a statement. They said that we are aware of the presence of these elements mm-hmm. in the kingdom. And in fact, even within the armed forces, there are certain elements that are aligned with them. Because mm-hmm. we need to keep in mind that this group, ISIS, has the same ideology of Wahhabism that the Saudis have, except that these people are even more extreme.
So it could be a family fight.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, if... and I wish that these ISI thugs would actually go into Saudi Arabia, and you know, that would be really something to watch.
It'd be nice for them to go home.
Absolutely. we'd have a ringside view of, yeah. of a really nice sort of, you know, gladiatorial contest.
Yeah. This is Zafar Bedgesh, Crescent International. I do recommend there are several articles about this. All through the region, strange things are going on. There are black flags of this organization flying apparently in Lebanon and in Jordan, I understand. Not that they're, you know, have hegemony or anything, but they're showing up.
Yes, of course. In fact, what their quote-unquote achievement in Iraq has done is to embolden their sympathizers and supporters all over the region. In fact, the Jordanian regime just released a person, Abu Qatada, who was known as, or he was accused of terrorism, but the Jordanian regime said that, no, there is no proof against him, because mm-hmm. the Jordanian regime wishes to use him and his followers against sympathizers of ISIS, mm-hmm. Because that's where, you know, since 2012, these elements were being trained by the CIA and American Special Forces in Jordan, mm-hmm. on the northern border of Jordan, and from there they were being launched into Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see that for 2 years, the Americans have been closely aligned with this group, and I'm sure that they have widespread sympathy in Jordan as well, because Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and places Qatar and Kuwait, etc., have the same kind of ideological mindset, which is the Wahhabi mindset that is being promoted and pushed mm-hmm. in the region.
Yeah. And Zafar, isn't, in terms of history, isn't this all, particularly the violent part, a reaction to the establishment of the Islamic Republic in Iran?
Absolutely.
Where it became immediately a challenge to the credibility of people calling themselves Islamic leaders in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, absolutely. That, in fact, everything that is taking place over there is ultimately aimed against the Islamic Republic of Iran, because that's the only country that has emerged completely independent. Whatever decisions they make are their own decisions. They are not dictated to. And also, because they established an Islamic government in Iran that has exposed the fraudulent claims of the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, and the others that used to claim that they were Islamic and that they carried the Islamic flag, and yet that fraud was exposed because the Saudis were shown to be completely corrupt. They were exposed to be completely incompetent and also subservient to U.S. and Zionist interests. And so in that sense, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, and all of these other tribal, you know, medieval regimes have been exposed as a consequence of the success of the Islamic Revolution.
And they've reacted with hysteria.
Absolutely.
Their language is hysterical, and their practice is terror.
Yes, absolutely. But I think ultimately this terror will not only fail, I think it would come back to haunt the very sponsors of terror, because unfortunately terror has no boundaries. You know, those that are currently applauding, financing, and supporting these terrorist thugs, these cannibals and mass murderers, ultimately will come back to, you know, deal with Saudi Arabia, with Kuwait, with Jordan. And in fact, I think Western governments, whether they are in France or Britain or elsewhere, that are that have allowed you know, disgruntled elements from their countries to go to go and join the ISIS thugs, that they will ultimately come back and they will create chaos in these societies as well.
Yes.
And I think it will be a direct result of the policies of these governments. But unfortunately, what I see is that the broad mass of Muslims living in these societies will pay the price for the follies of the policies of the government.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a sad reality. I'm really glad you made that point about the situation in Syria. It seems to me the people voted for the obvious candidate, the one who was against terror.
Absolutely. Exactly.
You know, why anybody would find it strange or shocking, it's not about is he the handsomest, or, but who is it's going to fight these guys? And he would.
That's
so
correct.
He gets elected.
Absolutely. Yes.
Zafar Ben-Gaish, we're really grateful. Crescent International, terrific articles, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
My great pleasure, Phil. Take care.
Take care.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Zafar Ben-Gaish, and it is a great site. I remind you, we were speaking earlier to David Hoyle, and it's AfricaResearchCenter.org, and the book is Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court. And, Phil, you have a program coming up Wednesday, 6 p.m.?
Yes, and I've got a real interesting find. We're going to play, in, to honor the Americans on July 4th, the Star-Spangled Banner, but as it was written, in the form in which it was written.
And well, that's how we celebrate Canada here.
Well, of course. And as a 19th century piece of music, which is what it is.
Yeah, well, that's great. And by the way, I hope you would look for who is Copeland, Aaron Copeland.
Of course,
I always play Aaron Copeland. He wrote a May Day piece, and I located that recently. So, which I have to get.
All right,
you
now you've found something I haven't heard. There you go.
See, I'm like every kid. I'm growing up with the internet. All right, this is the Taylor Report. Thank you, Terry, and we'll see you next week.